world. But to change the world in a way that means anything, it's slow, it's methodical.
Welcome to 2-Bit Encryption, the officially unofficial podcast for Mr. Robot on USA. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And we are talking about Season 3, Episode 8, titled Episode 3.7, _ Don't Delete Me.ko. Did you understand what the Don't Delete Me thing was all about?
Trenton, well, I mean, it's
you were about to say a very simplistic explanation for
right.
it.
Right, it's Trenton's email, but also this is an elaborate suicide episode.
It is, yeah. Which, interestingly, I didn't fully understand till about probably 3/4 of the way through this episode. Huh. I thought it was more about getting rid of Mr. Robot.
How do you think he was going to do it other than killing himself?
Getting rid of that jacket.
I thought
that was the link he had back to his father at that moment. But on second watch, I mean,
it's not even
thinly veiled. It's just there on the surface.
Yeah, sometimes you miss what's in front of you.
For sure. I was reading a thread on Reddit where they were talking about the after show.
Yeah.
From I don't know, whatever fucking outlet does their after show, and
USA Network.
They were talking about how shitty it was and how like they totally didn't get the point of it and like they just make bad jokes and all this stuff and they didn't talk deeply about the episode. I'm like, I don't know if I could do an instant take on this show.
Yeah.
Sometimes, because there's a lot to process in these, and I feel like if I don't sit down for a couple of hours and just think about what I watched, I don't fully understand it until I do that, and especially with episodes like this.
Right.
Because this is not your run-of-the-mill Mr. Robot episode. This is much deeper.
On the other hand, the official show's got, like, Sam Esmail and the writer. Like, I don't feel like it's your standard instant take. Like,
no, they can kind of guide the conversation.
Yeah, I think Sam Esmail's like, I don't know what's going to happen next, but it's, yeah, they kind of know where the thing's going.
He's not going to give you spoilers, but he can explain the episode.
I've heard that it's unsatisfyingly loose. And kind of like surface level and glib.
I've watched a couple of episodes I did not like it.
See, I watched a couple last year, but like I wasn't sure if I didn't like because of the format or because I thought they seemed smug and self-congratulatory for a product that I wasn't entirely happy with.
Okay.
Whereas like if, you know, like for example, the official Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul podcast are kind of that same... You know, smart me and self-congratulate. But, like, you know, for the most part, I enjoy Vince Gilligan's work. So if he's wanting to dunk on a podcast and talk about how wonderful job everyone's doing, it's like, okay, whatever.
And he's the guy who made it. He's not, like, there to talk about it and be all congratulatory and fanboy over it.
Right.
And it was the surprising lack of depth of coverage. The discussion just went nowhere interesting. It was all surface level in the episodes that I've watched. But... I don't know. Maybe we can be accused of the same sometimes.
Oh, fuck yeah.
I have no idea.
We're 3 minutes into this, and I don't think we've talked about what we thought about the episode.
No. What'd you think about
it? What the hell? What'd you think of the episode?
What'd you think of it?
I brought it up first. You waited. You had 3 minutes. You just fucked around. So now you're on the spot.
I love this episode.
Okay, good. I was worried.
I thought this was a much-needed breather from the non-stop foot to the floor action that we've had.
But not a filler episode.
No.
Because
a lot of
important character moments and like...
I felt very much like this about this episode like I did about The Fly from Breaking Bad. And I know a lot of people hated that episode. Yeah. And I think this one is probably just as divisive, but...
I don't think just as divisive, but we did get a couple of I got a representative negative take, which I understand.
Right.
I understand where it's coming from because sometimes any let up of tension or the brinksmanship, frankly, that's been going on this entire season can feel like a letdown. But when you really, I think if you look at it and over the course of time, you think about like, because it's a long time coming. Like the obvious solution to what you do if you're a clinically depressed person whose brain's not working right and also has this goblin inside you that just goes and kills thousands of
people without your
control is to kill yourself.
And you've tried every other possible
You've tried everything.
Fix.
You've tried everything and you're desperate. It would be weird if Elliot had never thought about it, you know? And like the fact that he came through and he made a plan and he was like, you know, making plans with Darlene and to deal with his dog. Like, it felt like a man who was setting his affairs to order. I thought it was great. I thought the stuff between the kid was great. I liked the more fantastic kind of like, I think it's intentional. You're supposed to not understand if entirely all this is a dream or real. I have very strong opinions on that, but like, you know, they're encouraging to kind of enter this dream space. And it's gorgeous. Like the shot of Elliot and that kid, is it Muhammad?
Muhammad, yeah.
In the mosque was gorgeous, and the final
overheads,
with Angela and Elliot on two sides of the doors, was amazing too.
And it's not meant to be. I don't feel like any of this, whether you believe it's a dream that Elliot's having or whatever. I don't believe that any of this is meant to be taken literally, real. Like we've seen the inside of Angela's apartment. It's not black, but they're going for a thematic thing here. They're going for a feel and a look and a vibe. And like when people look at those things and they say, oh, what does this mean? Her entryway hall is not white anymore. It's black now. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean anything. It just means they're going for an aesthetic, feel.
I do think it does. It is indicative of the characters. And
well, I mean, I look back at like people talking about, what's her name? His therapist's office or her home office. Oh, the books are all red. What does it mean?
Oh, I'm like, yeah.
There's nothing, because Angela's hall is not fucking red, and her entryway is not black. We've seen that conclusively.
No.
It's just something
like,
they're going for thematically.
It's not a Rosetta Stone, but like, you know, colors and temperatures of things mean something, and it's supposed to evoke a particular feeling in the viewer.
But it doesn't mean they're in a different universe or a different time or another life or anything. It's there to make you feel something. And this is weird because I don't feel like I have a good grasp on what I can say about this episode, because I felt it more than I understood it, like intellectually.
Right.
You just kind of feel this episode on a base level. And
there's a lot of
intuitive. It's hard to really talk about. I don't quite know how to go there.
Yeah. No, there's a lot of intuitives and stuff you have to intuit in this episode.
Yeah. So the name don'tdeleteme.ko,
bro,
I guess
don'tdeleteme.co.
KO is like it's a Linux kernel object, a file, and essentially it is a module that you can load into the kernel that contains device drivers or file system drivers.
It's a way to extend the Linux kernel functionality,
right? And do so in a way that doesn't load everything. You can load them individually, so you can just, you know, preserve your memory, so you don't have to load it all.
Do you think there's any special, because I'm starting to think that these don't really tie into the meaning of the episode.
I'm with you. I don't think there's a lot of info in those file extensions at the end of them, to the point where I don't know that I want to keep talking about them, because some of them are so obscure to me at this point. Like, I'm not a Linux user big time.
Right.
I've used it in the past, but fuck, I don't know about kernel modules. So.
Right. Yeah, I don't know either, and it also, because there's just not that many. I just feel like it's a stylistic thing. I also don't think there's any meaning between the fact that Trenton got a Bruce Springsteen CD burn and
Mobley got DJ Mobley.
Like, yeah, obviously the DJ Mobley, but the Trenton's Springsteen. I guess he's a Jersey boy. So yeah,
I think so.
Yeah, they probably. So I don't know. Maybe Sam Esmail and the series DVD that comes in a fishbowl.
Mm-hmm.
When you have all five seasons on Blu-ray, he'll explain that, like, if you take all the extensions and you put them through a Caesar Rot 13 cipher,
right?
It spells out the grand unification theory.
Yep. I did find it interesting that Trenton must just be using her initial handle that she started hacking with, right? Like, day one, she's a script kitty. She fires up, I don't know, fucking ICQ and says, God damn it, I need a handle. She fires up IRC and says, I can't join this room without a handle. She goes, my brother was born Trenton. That's good. Mm-hmm. And she never changed it, because this is a bad hacker name. This is giving information away.
Oh, that's true.
That you wouldn't want to give away if you're a hacker.
That's true. But Elliot's email is like elliot.anderson at hacker.com or
that's true.
At secureemail.com. But
for sure.
I don't know. Yeah, what's in the other thing I want to talk about just thematically is how this episode in itself turns a lot of things on its head about what we think about, like, you know, Mobley's brother. Like, our first interaction with him, we think one thing, and by the end of the episode, we think different. The drug dealer, we think differently. The little kid, we think differently about. And I feel like last episode, when Trenton was talking about how her brother was going to be nervous about her, or going to be angry, like, I got in my head, like, a bigger, more protective brother, and it turns out it's just the opposite. It's just her little brother who's so vulnerable. Yeah. There's a lot of things that got, and even our we get a lot of recalibration of how we think Mr. Robot, his origin, and Elliot's relationship with his father, and a lot of things. Like, this episode is a lot about, you know, taking what we thought we knew about characters and situations and flipping them, both contained entirely within this episode and throughout the entire series. Yep. Like, it'd be interesting if you look back, like, say this runs for 4 or 5 seasons, and if this episode, it feels like a fulcrum. Mm-hmm. It feels like a point where Elliot's like, he hits rock bottom and decides not to take the easy, decisive way out, and to, like, you know, I'm gonna get up and I'm gonna fight. Fuck this.
Yeah.
And that felt exciting. It felt like a declaration, a manifesto of sorts.
Mm-hmm. And it also kind of touches on, you know, the way we treat Muslims in this country.
Yeah.
There's a lot going on in this episode, and I don't know. I think it's an important step forward, and this is a good moment to do this kind of episode, because what else are you going to do? I mean, he's got no options. I mean, how is he? The stage two has gone off. He doesn't have a way to fight back against Mr. Robot or White Rose or whoever he thinks is doing this and is in charge.
And it does seem
there's
like
this 3-week cooling off period. Yeah. Now he has to deal with the consequences of the thing that he created.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I felt like this was a much needed episode that happened at just the right time.
I totally agree.
Okay, maybe we should get into the recap.
Before we do that, I wanted to take one mention to talk about Tot Dab, which, as I kind of thought would happen in the beginning, so I got a lot of email like, what is this Tot
Dab? You explain it literally every single episode.
I try to, but like, it's so, one thing that I got negative feedback for is I would tend to like go on a 10-minute rant anytime something socioeconomically did not line up in the show with what I thought would be the reality if 2/3 of the consumer debt in the country were wiped out, or we had a financial catastrophe like the Great Depression, you know? Like a lot of things, like, why does lower to middle class people have disposable income? So it's kind of thing going on. And I,
how can Ellie afford new computers?
How can Ellie afford new computers and new clothes and all this, even though he hasn't been in work for 6 months, he's in jail. Like, you know, where did all this stuff, although wasn't there like a life insurance? He's kind of doesn't have to even work. Is that true?
Maybe. Or hacking. Hacking can be the
band-aid
there.
That's true. He just steals money when he needs. He's a digital Robin Hood. But I came up with this thing because, like, instead of taking 10 minutes to just, like, vent my spleen, I came up with this Tot Dab scale, which stands for that one thing that drives Aaron batshit. And I could be like, the Tot Dab's at a 7 out of 10. And, you know, that's like, the people that agree with me can, like, yeah, totally. And the people that get tired of me bitching about this, like, I'd spit 30 seconds.
Right.
So if I have to explain this every 4 episodes, it's still probably money and episode time ahead.
Was there a lot of Tot Dab in this episode?
A little bit, but I don't know. I don't, like I said, a lot of this show is so dreamy that I will put up with a lot of Tot Dab. I'll put up with Magic and Dragons if the show is good. I'll put up with you know, lasers making noise in space if the show's good. I'll put up with Tot Dab if the show's good. Season 3 of Mr. Robot is really, really good.
Yeah.
Like, it's so good that I'm starting to think, like, where should I properly evaluate it? Like, that's something I'm going to have to do in January when we have our Baldies. Like, this thing is covering ground. Like, I didn't expect it to make the top 10. It's certainly going to be in the top 10.
Mm-hmm.
And it's heading towards the top 5. And, like, can it crack the top 3? It's still got 2 episodes to go, which episodes that you can dig itself into a hole, or episodes where it can really get sublime. So I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I'm with you. It's exceeded my expectations. And granted, I have very low expectations going in to season 3 because I did not like season 2. But even after like the first few episodes, I thought, okay, Mr. Robot is back to form. And it has gone beyond, I think, even season one as far as how good it is.
I thought season one was good until the final two episodes I had problems with, which I guess could be this season again. But like, if they continue to, if they stick the landing, then this is obviously the best season of Mr. Robot of all time and is kind of historically good, too, sure. I think, for me.
More generally among television.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. We ready for a recap now?
Yes. Let's do it.
Hey, before we get to the episode proper, I want to do some housekeeping. We got a couple of Bald Move events still coming up. We got, you know, the finish of The Walking Dead over the next 2 weeks, finish of Mr. Robot. We got the Disaster Artist movie.
Oh, yeah. It's next week.
Next week's going to be awesome. And the week after that, Star Wars, first-run Bald Movies. Check that out on our Bald Movies feed. But the real thing we're excited about is in the off-season, in December, Jim and I typically have a Bald Move Christmas extravaganza. This year is no different. We're going to be for... This is exclusive for club members only. It's the Mary Culkin Keatmas. We're going to be watching Jack Frost, Home Alone, and Batman Returns, the Michelle Pfeiffer and Danny DeVito as Penguin episode, which is Christmas themed. All these movies are Christmas themed.
Yep.
We do a live watch for each of them, which is a way we do commentary where you can watch the movie with us. We do podcasts for each one. And then on the corresponding Friday lunches with Jim and Aaron, we drink a lot and we do super long lunch editions. There's going to be other surprises. There's going to be a surprise for Christmas Day. But, yeah, it's a Christmas extravaganza. If you want to get in on it, you got to join the club, club.baldmove.com. Stealth ad for the club. Also, as an enticement, no, I'm going to wait. I'm going to wait for the actual club ad for that. I'm doing too much selling. Let's get back to the episode.
All right, we start off with young Elliot going to the movies with his dad. He clearly doesn't want to be there. He's angry that his father pushed him out the window, I think that's what they're talking about.
He's got the sling on his arm, so I think that's what you're supposed to understand.
Also, he won't admit that he's sick, and he calls him out for that. And Edward says, yeah, you're right. Asks him if he can ever forgive him. And then he collapses on the floor when Elliot says no. And Elliot takes his jacket and goes to watch the movie where he kind of, I guess, speaks for the first time to Mr. Robot. That's the impression that I got here, is that this is the moment Mr. Robot was created.
I think that is an inference that one could make. Now, so there's been a lot of theories that keep developing over the Mr. Robot and when it was. And there is a popular theory about Mr. Robot forming before the Elliot Anderson actually, or Edward Alderson died. And the latest one came out of this week is that the Elliot created the Mr. Robot persona to deal with his father's cancer diagnosis, and him being pushed out the window is Elliot throwing himself out the window as punishment for breaking his father's confidence. That this was the first instance of Mr. Robot, the persona, hurting Elliot to establish control and domination, which nicely mirrors the parallel of him being thrown off the pier in season one. I've really progressively liked these new Mr. Robot theories, and I think this is the best permutation yet.
Okay.
That explains why, you know, Elliot's dad is so nonchalant about the fact that he just broke his son's arm.
Yeah.
Like, it's more like, will you forgive me for making you keep a secret from your mom because you massively overreacted into it, than, oh, I'm sorry for throwing you out a second story window. Why can't you just fucking enjoy this stupid movie?
Right. And there's a lot of inconsistency about what Elliot says about their relationship leading up to his death.
Do you want to talk about that? Because I'm unconvinced that they're real inconsistencies.
Yeah, me too. I'm honestly more convinced that it's Elliot's guilt and his him trying to cover for that, you know, seeing the relationship very differently than it actually was. But potentially people are talking about, oh, maybe he's already got the Mr. Robot in him, and so he sees Mr. Robot as his father at that point and has a very different relationship than he does with actual Edward.
Well, Cora Adana, who is the technical advisor, writer/slash producer, confirmed in an interview that this is the actual day Edward Alderson died.
Yeah.
Alderman. Jesus.
Alderson.
Oh, is it Alderson? Okay. Yeah. So we know that.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't buy that the person collapsing is actually Mr. Robot, like, because the crowd reacted to him. Okay.
Right, yeah.
And, like, you know, the fact that Elliot said, like, you know, ever since my dad pushed him out of the window, we never really talked, and we... Like, people are like, well, he's talking to him. I'm like, is he really? Like, I don't think this is... You compare this to their relationship from before the window incident. This is not... Like, I would think this qualifies for not having a relationship.
Yeah.
And being closed off.
But it seemed... But the way he describes it, it was the other side of it was the problem. Like, his dad wouldn't talk to him. And he was very closed off. But this seems exactly the opposite to me. And that could be Elliot... reversing the situation to kind of deal with his guilt.
Right.
Or to avoid his guilt, I guess.
Right.
I don't know.
And Mr. Robot twists the truth around himself. Like, I could totally see him gaslighting Elliot as far as what his relationship with his father was. Like, you know, think about it. Like, if this alternate personality has been in his head for, you know, since he's 10 years old.
That's kind of what I mean, about that's avoiding bad. The guilt. Yeah. Is his version of his dad is telling him one thing.
And we already know that Elliot's an unreliable narrator. He lies to us intentionally. He lies to us by omission. He lies to us because he cannot correctly identify social cues. So, like, his memory of his father's relationship is very suspect. I don't believe anything that I don't see with my own two eyes, you know, on the screen.
Anything more to say about that? I like the old intro to the movie. That was kind of nice.
So that was really cool. And, like, is that... My question was... Because that's so close to being the actual Cinemark, this is the movie starting, bad 90s CGI kind of thing, that I'm wondering if it actually was,
or they
recreated it for the show. Because there's something about the, like, the hideous popcorn texture. And
yeah, the gumdrops.
The gumdrops. It just is so, like
following the film reel,
You can do this in CG, but you should wait. You should wait till Lord of the Rings drops so you can actually get some realistic texture on that popcorn.
Yeah.
But, yeah, like, that hokey kind of, like, faux movie kind of, I
definitely remember seeing things that looked like that.
Yeah. But that's the thing. It's like you never can tell whether the show actually just made something that looks like that or if they just fucking licensed one.
Right, especially when we're dealing with an episode where Back to the Future.
They ain't afraid to shell out for 15 seconds of Back to the Future, too. That's for sure.
Features prominently. So, all right, we go to present-day Elliot. He is reading news stories about Mobley and Trenton while burning their info to CD, and he's pondering the concept of deletion as it kind of relates to... I thought on first viewing his father and Mr. Robot, but on second viewing, it's definitely himself. He does the most thorough wipe down ever before Darlene shows up.
We saw that
cutting chips off his fucking board.
We've seen him do that in season one, too.
Yeah, I didn't remember it being this severe, but
The microwave and the chips. Yeah. So.
She wants him to help her get Angela out of her funk, but Elliot is kind of at the end of his own rope and starts screaming about how he can't get rid of Mr. Robot. And, oh, by the way, Mr. Robot is me, and I liked all of this stuff. And Darlene gets so scared that they sit down, and Elliot promises they'll watch Careful Massacre tomorrow. Which
Man, what a
happen.
Shitty thing. In retrospect, this is, like, one of the biggest acts of cowardice I've seen Elliot do, because he knows... Yeah. In this moment, I think he actually comes to the realization right now that, like, in lieu of her not leaving him alone, like, he comes to the conclusion that he's going to kill himself, and he's like, you know what? And he almost flips the switch. Like, he makes all these promises he knows he's not going to keep, and his sister's going to come over and probably get a call from somebody tomorrow morning that her brother's been found dead of a opioid overdose on the beach.
Yeah.
And, like, what? Wow, Elliot. Wow.
No, it's rough. And I think...
But on the other
hand,
that's...
Both of them do just deliver excellent performances in this scene. I mean, just the way that, like, neither of them can, like, really look at each other.
Right.
But there's also this connection between them, and they both understand each other. And then Elliot, there's this other level where he knows he's going to kill himself. And it's...
Well, and I catch myself, I'm putting these moral judgments on Elliot, like how selfish and how cowardly. But on the other hand, he's a mentally ill guy who's clinically depressed.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
And he's actively killing and hurting people
every
day.
Right. That's like how much
rational control does he have mm-hmm. over the way he is feeling and acting at this point? Like, he is yeah. wanting to kill themselves or kill himself, which is the most extreme thing a person can take.
Yeah.
Extreme action. So,
and I don't know what other recourse he has at this point, other than, I guess, that Hail Mary at the very end where he finds yeah. the email.
But it's so funny because, like, up until, like, you know, we've thought that, like, you know, Mr. Robot and Elliot are just, you know, these masters. And I remember there's this conversation about, like, you know, Philip and Zhang / White Rose debating who is the most powerful person in the room. And we uh-huh. thought, like, you know, who would, like, maybe Elliot's more powerful. And, like, at this point in time, Elliot has zero power. And the fact that he talks about this grandiose plan he and Mr. Robot came up with, that he admitted that he, like, this is his Walter White, I was good at it and I liked it kind of realization.
Yeah.
But he just was
a pawn. It's so much more tragic,
he thought,
too.
He thought he was the guy behind the chessboard weighing right. the moves, and he just now realized he's a pawn.
Yeah. And that's why it's so much more tragic, because Walter White, every step of the way, he was in some form of control, pushing his right. own destiny forward, whereas right. Elliot is just being manipulated and controlled the entire time.
Yep.
And never saw it. So,
yeah.
We also learn in the scene it's been 3 weeks since the attacks.
Yes.
The 71 buildings blew up.
Actually, you know, as far, and there's a lot of other stuff. There's a lot of interesting critical jabs and also admissions here, because, like, in this episode, if you freeze frame on the article that Elliot's reading on the computer, there's this line where the newspaper is kind of covering the whole history of F Society, and they're like, oh, they hold up in this abandoned arcade that was literally called F Society, and the UN was burnt out, and it was really literally F Society. And then it says, a bit on the nose if you ask us. Which is, you know, that I think we used that phrase probably two or three times talking sure. about last year's coverage. And then later in the episode where Elliot opines that what the fuck the critics, like, critics don't know anything.
Yeah.
I thought, like, this one was Sam Elliott's, like, okay, maybe you've got a fair point. And then later on was him, like, also, fuck you.
Yeah, no, I feel like
this isn't easy. Like, you know?
I feel like he does the, like, set you up and then knock you down sort of thing.
Yeah.
A lot.
Yeah,
and it works. It's pretty effective because it gets me thinking, like, why does Sam Elliott hate the Martian so much? What does he have against the fucking Martian? And then the kid's like, no, it's just Matt Damon's awesome. Right. And the Martian might actually be a just fun movie if you want to turn your fucking brain off
right.
for a second and not have to worry about, not have to think that every goddamn movie you see is the most important thing you've ever seen.
Well, also,
just have some fun with it, too,
There's a meta conversation on Reddit where this also makes sense that Elliot would instinctively dislike this movie, because what is Elliot's one unescapable crushing pain is the loneliness he feels in society.
Sure.
And the Martian, for a lot of its runtime, is a meditation about how a man can deal with the most isolated a human being can be.
Yeah.
Which would, you know, like, I don't know, would that be heaven or hell for Elliot? Because he's lonely, but he also,
I feel like he would say that's his heaven, but it would actually be his hell. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's my guess.
Yeah. And then there's, like, also if you freeze frame, there's all a bunch of stuff about breathless reporting about the Red Wheelbarrow Barbecue being mm-hmm. a F Society front. And
yep.
Yeah. Like this isn't, like, the 3 week time jump's interesting because it tells us a lot of things without telling us. Number one, Elliot and Darlene have miraculously been saved from the FBI investigation because yeah. of cooperation. Two, Dark Army doesn't consider them, like, they have so effectively planted this alternate story, which, little tot dabby for me, like,
uh-huh. That Elliot couldn't blow it wide open if he wanted to.
Just that, I guess I have a higher opinion of journalists mm-hmm. than Sam Esmail does. Like, I do, like, this is part, and there's a piece of feedback I got about my rant on conspiracy theories last week, but this goes back to it. Like, I mean, I don't know, the fact that you could maybe get this to be the first 24, 48 week, 2 weeks, but, like, there's no way this story could withstand a year's worth of journalistic scrutiny, I don't think. And maybe White Rose won't care by the time this turns out to be, you know, the point,
points to China, then she can like blame Philip because he's obviously super involved in it. Like I don't know. It's a low top dab irritation, but it's a bit of one.
Okay. Let's go to the next scene where Elliot drops the dog off at the neighbor's house. It's just a quick one. He talks a little bit more about deletion as he drops
his father's. George Martin can't fucking finish his books. He's babysitting Elliot's dogs all the goddamn time. You know, if he could
and
just...
getting portraits painted of himself with dogs.
Yeah, come on, George. Sit down and fucking finish the wins at least. At least.
Yeah, so he's talking more about deletion as he drops off his father's jacket at the burn center. I guess... there's a center that will pay you for donated clothes in eCoin that they just burn?
So this, and again...
Are they generate like steam engine shit? What's happening
little
here?
Little Todd Dabby, I think you're supposed to understand is there is no more trash service, so you have to like...
Oh, you pay them
But it's illegal to dump. So
right.
This is a scam where they're you pay them to... and then obviously they're just taking it to...
It's not illegal to burn? Then why wouldn't people just burn in their yards?
Well,
maybe designated burn centers or
right, because like in a lot of cities
sanctioned?
you can't just an open fire, so
yeah,
but then I guess because they made it seem like the Mr. Robot Jag was getting thrown on the fire, obviously it didn't, so then I guess the thing is that this scam is that they just take the trash and dump it after curfew.
Yeah, I mean they're recycling their product, right? Like mm-hmm. they're putting their product back into circulation and then it comes back to them again.
Yeah.
It's a pretty good scam.
Yeah, but I just don't feel like, again, in a society that's not functioning, has no trash, like, I don't know why anyone would pay hard-earned eCoin to fucking have their trash disposed of. It would just keep up.
Just take it to Trenton and dump it.
Right, like, the rich people
Even going to notice.
like the rich people aren't going to live in neighborhoods where trash is mounded up and everybody else is not going to be able to, I can pay for an apple or I can have my trash removed. Guess what?
I'm getting that apple.
Yeah. So I felt like I don't understand the market, even a black or gray market for trash removal.
Yeah.
It seems ridiculous to me.
Todd Dabb at
Todd
what?
Dabb and we move
at,
on.
At what? What's the level?
Probably a 9.
A 9? Holy shit.
It just doesn't make any fucking sense. Who's the market? Who is paying? Like
people who are literally drowning in trash, I guess.
Right, like, right. Hmm. I mean, it makes the actually not burning and it's a whole scam, that makes sense, but like it's weird. It's weird. I'm trying to think of like what would the equivalent of like someone, you know, running a scam today? Like they're trying to sell you magic beans. Mm-hmm. Like, hey, if you get magic, be like,
I feel like
this
scam still exists. Like you can pay people to come and take away your junk.
Sure.
And they'll just
trash
turn around
service,
and scrap
right?
it or
yeah.
or get money out of it. Like you're paying someone to take something and give themselves money.
Yeah, but what if it costs like $500 mm-hmm. to have your refrigerator picked up? Would
That's
you
too much. I'd smash it in the backyard.
You just keep it in the backyard or you'd throw it in a creek somewhere, you know, or it just
drive it to Jersey.
You wouldn't participate in someone calling and be like, hey, we can remove that for $500 of your hard earned eCoin, you know?
Right. And we can sort of like devise the exchange rate a little bit here between USD and eCoin, at least at the time where Elliot bought that mirror, because you can see both dollars. It's like $270 to 50 Bitcoin or eCoins.
Okay. So eCoins seem like it's about today's money.
I honestly don't know
I mean,
how much exchange rate.
Like, how much an IKEA medicine cabinet would cost? Like $50? No, $50.
Oh, $50. Yeah, yeah.
So, like, eCoin is that's what a lot of people have been saying. The fact that eCoin is what everybody is actually paying in, and the American dollars is just, but yeah.
And I like this comparison when he's dropping off the dog to, you know, deciding to kill yourself and this yes no dialogue box. Are you sure?
Mm-hmm.
There's always that moment of hesitation. He's right, where you have to decide, are you going to delete this thing forever? Because it's unless you catch it, like, immediately it's gone.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the other thing I do like about his wipe down procedure is knowing a little bit about how computers work. you can delete something, and you can delete it permanently from your file system, but it is still there.
Right.
Like in your memory, on your hard drive, until it's overwritten by something else. It still exists, and you can retrieve it. So
that's why he's so concerned with physical destruction.
Right.
Because that's like, you know, drilling the platters of the hard drive is physically destroying the substrate that the data lives on, you know?
Yeah. Okay, then we go over to Elliot buying morphine from Hard Andy. And he wants more than Hard Andy is comfortable selling him.
Hard Andy wants more from Elliot than he's comfortable in giving.
For sure.
You can't have my shirt and my pants, but my dick belongs to me and me alone.
Yep. So Andy makes him strip to look for wires because he's suspicious. And finally realizes that he's not an undercover. He's probably just going to kill himself with that much morphine.
Yep.
So,
because he's in his experience, you're either a narc, you're trying to move in to the wholesale on his property,
trying to Walter White him,
or you have a death wish because life is just that bad.
Heisenberg,
stay out of my Hard Andy intimidating. Like I want to know what kind of goon squad Hard Andy has because he's perpetrating like.
Hard Andy's intimidating in that Andy Dick sort of way.
Yeah, it's like I say, he tells me stay out of my territory. I'm like, aw, and I just pet him, you know.
Which is to say, not very.
Right.
So Elliot goes to Mobley's brother's house to ask where he can go to pay his respects. And his brother is super pissed off about what Mobley did because of how it's affecting him and his life. And he tells off Elliot. Tells him to get the hell out of there.
Yeah, no, and this is great because, like, you think you're, like, this, like, you know, fucking Mobley, he's the ne'er-do-well brother who's destroying this Muslim who's probably already got it tough enough to go through society without his brother being a fucking terrorist. And by the end of the episode, realize he's not necessarily one of the good ones.
Yep. So Elliot getting shut down at Mobley's brother's house goes to Trenton's house to find her family preparing to move out of the city. He says some pretty nice things about her to her father, for which he's grateful, and her brother, Muhammad, sees everything. I thought it was interesting that she named herself after the city where her younger brother was born.
Really shows
kinda
the relationship.
Tells you, yeah.
Exactly.
How they feel about each other.
Exactly.
Or at least how she feels about him. I don't know. He feels bad about what his role in the whole thing might have been.
Also, like, so there's another thread on Reddit that remember the 71 cyber bombings, that was... Yeah. You're supposed to understand that this was a mourning over physical possessions and monetary loss more than people, but I don't know.
Yeah, I find that hard to swallow. I thought it was just more convenient than the 3,212 or whatever that died.
Right, right. Like, I've heard people say, like, you know, the day the Twin Towers fell, that doesn't mean people are sad about the Twin Towers. It means that it's a...
Yep.
Yeah, I thought that was... I thought that was, I mean, it could mean that, but like, I don't necessarily think it's a required or it's particular, even an Easter egg. I also, the whole time I was watching this, I was looking to get the answer to who Trenton sent the email to. Like, I'm sending some of the trust, and the way her father was just like, fuck this, I'm out. I was wondering maybe she sent, and that's why he was trying to like figure out what was going on with Elliot. And, turns out the person she trusted is Elliot himself.
Yeah, a little surprising.
Very surprising in retrospect, I think.
Yeah, it's kind of hiding in plain sight. Like, he would be the guy to send the email to, but...
Totally.
Didn't expect it.
Totally.
I do like that he's, you know, essentially looking to apologize to his friends before he goes.
Yeah.
Which is in stark contrast to the way he's treating Darlene.
Yeah.
He's lying to her.
But Darlene and Angela are in stark contrast to Trenton and Mobley, who never fucked him. Like, Darlene and Angela have both lied and manipulated him.
That's true.
And that's why he's like, I didn't find it puzzling that he's that calloused about Angela at all.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. Let's move on to Elliot sitting on the beach about to down a bag of morphine pills when Muhammad comes up, having followed him. Elliot just wants to get back to offing himself, but Muhammad won't go away, so Elliot walks him home.
I love Elliot's relationship with this kid. Like,
it's great.
Are you serious, man?
Dude, you can't just stay here.
Yeah, this is not cool. It's so great. It's like Elliot with a child is high comedy.
Yep. Yeah. Elliot walks him home. When they arrive, his family's gone. I don't know where the hell they are, but the kid mentions that he's never been to a movie, so Elliot volunteers to take him to one, but only because his parents are not going to be home for at least 2 hours. Because
they went to Connecticut or something.
The perfect amount of time to go watch Back to the Future 2.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And, you know, the whole thing, you think this kid is this, like, helpless, sad little puppy, and it turns out that he's been playing Elliot the whole time, and it's another inversion from what you think is happening to what is actually happening.
Yeah. And I haven't quite... That's one of the areas that I feel I haven't quite deciphered on this episode, like, what this kid's motivation is, really. Mm-hmm. If he's maybe looking for something that he thinks Elliot has.
I mean, I don't know. I think kids just act like, I think everyone acts out when they're going through severe emotional trauma. And I think the way children act out is even more bizarre because they're, you know, they don't have any real like life experience framework to put anything in context.
Mm-hmm.
So like, I don't know. Plus, they're helpless. They're in a large place. They're very vulnerable. So, like, a 27-year-old storming out of the house and going off into the city and hitting bars and is one level of, well, I'm worried about them. An 11-year-old hitting the streets just because he's grief-stricken about his sister and he's confused about what, you know, because he's very politically aware. Like, you know, the fact that I thought that was interesting, this little immigrant story about like him realizing he's the only person in his family who could be the president, and his sister's not only is she dead, but she's a terrorist, and
yeah,
and his mom and dad have to move. Like that's a lot, and like, you know, what is normal behavior to deal with that?
And he doesn't quite grasp the full weight of what's happening.
Sure.
Either.
Sure.
You know, this idea that he would be president with this in his past is foolish, but from a kid's perspective, he doesn't quite understand it.
Right.
And I thought it was interesting they're using tennis courts as detention centers.
Yeah, the fact that the New York is under military occupation with a strict curfew like this, that's the kind of time. Now we're talking.
Right.
Like, yes, this feels like a realistic, like a society board teetering on collapse anyway.
Yeah.
I just don't know where there's not more. It seems like there should be more people starving. There should be some like that's the whole top dab is like, and it might be more of a budget problem than an ignorance problem, but I'm not seeing the pain. This is exactly like in episode one, where every time the governor gets on the horn with Padme Amidala, he's like, the death toll is catastrophic. Your people are dying. But then every time we see Naboo, it's business as fucking usual.
Yeah.
Like, maybe
every time we go to Naboo, they're having a Back to the Future marathon.
Right.
What the fuck?
Right, with everyone in full costume. Uh-huh. And you're still buying big-ass popcorns and Cokes. It's like, yeah, it's like, I want, where's the pain?
Yes.
Yeah, where is the death toll being unimaginable, man? How many Gungans have died? I haven't seen a damn one.
Yep. All right, speaking of Back to Future marathons, here we go. There's one playing when they get to the movie theater, and Elliot makes Muhammad Eminem popcorn, and he listens to the people in line argue about what the movie Back to the Future 2 is about. Once the movie starts, Doc Brown, let's call him that, asks Elliot to hold his flux capacitor while he's cleaning his glasses. And then Muhammad uses that distraction to sneak out, and Elliot goes outside where he meets a Jewish ice cream man who agrees to take him to the mosque where Elliot thinks Muhammad is gone, and they talk about War of the Worlds while they drive. A lot of stuff happening here. I'm not quite sure I totally get it. Don't know what's up with the Elaines.
With the what?
Elaines, is that her name?
Elaines?
Yeah, Marty's mom.
Oh, right.
Like, there's two time period versions of her.
Yeah.
And she comes out and she says, oh, I should have been 50s Elaine.
I think some of, like, and I could be wrong, but I do think that because the show is deep and does stand up to in-depth scrutiny, it does lead the fan base to want to know what the meaning for everything is.
Sure.
Like, sometimes I do think, like, there's some things that are, you know, the couple passionately kissing, I thought might have been an allusion to George and Elaine's kiss and Back to the Future that made everything all better. Like, that this is the nadir of the story. This is the point of maximum you know, conflict and the heroes at the lowest point, and now we're going to pull like from this point forward, you know, Elliot as Michael J. Fox's photo is going to start solidifying. Mm-hmm. They're supposed to be, but like I think the two Elaine's coming out is just background comedy.
Okay.
I mean, does every thing have to mean everything?
I don't know. I mean, he hands him a flux capacitor.
What does it mean that his dad, like, putting M&Ms into popcorn?
Yeah.
Does that mean, like, Angela's the popcorn and Elliot is the M&Ms and he takes both types to make a delicious snack? I mean, some shit's just what it is. It's just surface.
I mean, I think the flux capacitor thing has to be somewhat important. I'm not saying, like, oh, Elliot's going to travel through time. But it could be a symbolic of him getting this email where he can undo things at the end of time or at the end of the episode.
Yeah.
So
I also think there's some of that was just kind of like it also served as a distraction.
Yeah, totally.
Because if the guy didn't hand him his big ass flux capacitor, Elliot would have noticed the kid piecing out.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. And so maybe now is a good time to talk about whether or not you think anything happening in this episode is real. Because the thing that grounds me in this episode and says, yes, it is in fact real, is the guy behind the concession stand says he saw the kid run out.
Indeed. And people said, well,
there
could
are
be
many kids. I'm sure.
You're right. You're right. But on the other hand, a kid running out within the last minute.
Yeah.
Like how many kids are running out of this theater? Like, I think that this is supposed to be like the spinning top in Inception. This is supposed to be our key that says this is real. There is a kid here. The Marty McFly who was explaining the plot mechanics was making eye contact with both Elliot and the little kid, and Sam Esmail is careful enough that if the kid is supposed to be a figment of imagination, that guy would have never have looked at anybody but Elliot.
Sure. Yeah.
And even then, we didn't talk about that. The fact that, like, there's this cute little, well, Back to the Future is about, you know, a person going to the future to change the past. No, actually, it's about going to the future to change the future. Then, yeah. And then someone's like, oh, actually, it's just about one mistake can change the world.
Right.
And people are like, oh, that means time travelers, no dimensional. And my response is, no, fuckers. Back to the Future 2 is about all those things.
Yeah.
Those are all accurate depictions of the plot.
Mm-hmm.
Like the woman coming in flying in the inn is not Sam Raimi throwing a bucket of, like,
Sam Raimi.
Sorry.
He belongs nowhere in this.
Sam Raimi throwing a shovel full of dirt on Bruce Campbell's face.
Uh-huh.
It's not necessarily Sam Esmail running in and throwing a bucket of cold water on the time travel. It's just,
sure.
It's just a funny meta conversation about the show.
Yeah.
That could, granted, it could be that.
And it could be a discussion about the meta conversation about the show,
yes,
right?
Like, yes.
Itself, because we are out there theorizing about everything and taking all the meanings we can from this show. That could just be Sam's way of saying, I acknowledge you.
Right.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I would caution this kid to not put too much weight in Rotten Tomatoes scores, because Rotten Tomatoes is not... is not gauging how good a movie is. It's gauging
how pacifying a movie is,
essentially. Like, right. How... it like I don't even know how to describe it.
If
it doesn't mean that there aren't critics who didn't like it. It means that...
it means that 70% of the critics that saw it had a favorite... If a tomato score is 70, then out of 10 critics, 7 of them would give it a favorable review and 3 of them wouldn't.
Right, so the more likely to have a higher score you are is how you can appeal to everyone.
Right.
So you're not going to necessarily go into The Avengers or whatever with a 90-something or The Martian with a 92
right.
and enjoy that movie simply because most people enjoy it.
Right.
It's not saying anything about the quality of it.
Art house type of person.
Right.
You know, might hate the Avengers.
Yeah, you really need to get further than a score to ever fully qualify something like that.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
There's a couple of... So what do you think about the ice cream serving, Muslim-friendly rabbi playing War of the Worlds that he has an optimistic take on? I thought it was a great character.
It was, yeah.
And this is the type of weirdo... Like again, if you're gonna like play around with the top dab scale, like this is the kind of weirdo, bizarre, niche-y kind of like what the fuck, almost Mad Max type of character that you like. And also, I do feel like some of this episode is talking about like basic humanity. and that's not a necessarily something like basic humanity is not something that secularism or religious institutions have a stranglehold on. It's something mm-hmm. that it can dwell within any of us. Would a religious devout person, because this guy's I believe a Hasidic Jew, which is like mm-hmm. the espresso yeah. version of Judaism.
Sure.
Or at least it can be, and yet this guy is on very friendly terms with the imams at several local Islamic centers in New York, and that's cool. That's yeah. really cool.
Yeah, and his message is one of human perseverance,
right.
And that's the interesting thing to me is that we can have all of this stuff go down, and people can be in very bad situations, but ultimately that human spirit comes through and. We survive it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I'm kind of a sucker for those types of
yeah,
stories.
Yeah, we want to hear that because we don't want to be living through the end of yeah. the fucking world. We want to, and that's...
Even in an end of the world scenario,
right.
like he's describing, War of the Worlds.
Like, I've been trying to, you know, if you were, like the fact that, like, as bad as it was to be a Jew or a gypsy or a homosexual in a Nazi death camp, it's pretty fucking bad.
Mm-hmm.
Humanity has then gone on to thrive since then.
Sure.
As bad as it was to be when the Black Plague was rampaging through Europe, mm-hmm. humanity survived and thrived. As bad as smallpox was in the New World, humanity continued to survive and thrive despite the fact that an asteroid obliterated most of the life on Earth 67 million years ago. Like, it is like in the darkest hour, there's still going to be rays of light, and there's still going to be acts of heroism, compassion, and as
yeah.
long as that continues to be, then we'll survive till the next asteroid.
And so much of our survival is tied up in that idea of never giving up,
right?
And I think that strikes a note here with Elliot, who is about to give up.
Mm-hmm. And there's also an interesting thing from a person who is like, there's a couple of, there's a thread about like suicide and depression. And they talked, there's the OP, the original parent post was saying that he thought it was interesting that Elliot, the turnaround point or the beginning of his turnaround was realizing that this Back to the Future thing is something he had looked forward to his whole life.
Mm-hmm.
Like sometimes, like when you're in the depths of depression, remembering a time when you were happy or anticipating is like, well,
yeah.
shit, I haven't always felt this way, so maybe I won't feel this way again. That can be like a real breakthrough when you're
yeah.
clinically depressed. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was like some of this stuff that the show does is pretty incredible. If I don't know if they were trying to suggest that or that's just part of the narrative, but the fact that it can speak to people who have had suicidal ideation and tendencies and be in the depths of clinical depression is, shit, that's really good storytelling.
Yeah, and I think it's also tied in. They let, in typical Mr. Robot fashion, they let the scene kind of linger a little bit longer than necessary to get
yeah.
all the dialogue in.
Yeah.
And you can hear the War of the Worlds description at the end say another life, a life that has no continuity with the present.
Right.
And you can kind of look at that through that lens, the
yeah.
suicide, right? Like, you were once happy. I know right now you are very depressed and things look like they will never turn around, but there can be another life that has no continuity with the present.
Hmm.
Or you can take it to say an alternate universe where none of this shit ever happened and everybody's happy and Angelo is joyful
yeah.
again.
Yeah, indeed.
But I don't know. That's one thing they do so well here is sort of confuse and muddy the waters.
It honestly reminds me a lot of some of the best of The Leftovers.
Yeah.
Which is, if you if you listen to our podcast, that's high fucking praise.
Yep. All right, we move on to Elliot finding Muhammad alone at the mosque. And they shout at each other, during which Muhammad says, "I wish you were dead." Elliot says, "I wish I was too." And Muhammad says that he feels like he's responsible for what his sister did. And Elliot tells the kid to put the blame on him instead. And Muhammad starts talking about how he's the only one in his family who could be a dictator. And they talk about where they were born. He doesn't use the term dictator. He doesn't even know the term dictator, but Elliot does.
He just wants to make everyone like him.
Yeah,
that's all.
And eat Pop-Tarts for dinner.
Yeah, nothing. But that's a dictator. It's like a really bad president.
Yeah, pretty much.
This scene
is beautiful.
It is beautiful.
I can't get over those overhead shots of that carpet with him standing next to each other.
And it's funny because
the first time I've seen the inside of a mosque, but it's only the second time that I've it's the first time I've seen a mosque on American television that did not have like, oh, this is a terrorist cell,
right,
that Keith or Sutherland's going to bust in,
fucking dirt floors,
or Carrie Matheson from Homeland's going to come in here and chase out some dude that some fucking imam that's been on the take and he's wearing all black robes.
Yeah, this is a well-appointed mosque.
It is. It's not funny, but it's nice, and it's
yeah.
It's what's cool about it is it shows it for what it really is. It's a lot like any other like Christian community
center. Place of worship. Yeah,
there's nothing weird going on in here. There's like, I thought it's interesting that I'll do a lot
because
the Muslim center in Plainfield, the one I've been inside, had this similar type of carpet where it's like faux individual squares of carpet.
Okay.
To kind of like delineate, like here's where your nose and here's where your asshole goes, and
okay,
like
sure.
Muhammad was saying there.
Yeah, yeah.
But I wonder if that's like kind of because like I've gone around a lot of churches, it seems like they all have the same kind of pew style or the same kind, because it works, right?
Yep.
You got the little hoop for the little cup of wine, and you got the little rack for the prayer books and your song books and all that kind of shit. Like, mm-hmm. do all mosques have like, you either have like a bare floor that everybody brings their own BYOC, mm-hmm. bring your own carpet. Or they have this like faux individual square carpets just so everybody knows where to get down?
It's probably similar.
Yeah.
In whatever mosque you go to.
Yeah.
I don't know. I've never been in a mosque personally. I don't know that I've ever been in like, I've been in Catholic churches for weddings and stuff, but never to worship. okay, let's move on to Elliot and Muhammad arriving home. Muhammad pulls out a key and he opens up the front door, which kind of upsets Elliot a little bit.
Oh, the other thing is like,
yeah.
Before this last scene, speaking of overanalyzing it, did you think that when the kid was screaming at Elliot about like, you know, all these invectives, and then also he made Elliot take his shoes off, that this was supposed to be kind of like suggesting that Elliot's being called into the carpet to like, you know, this is for him to get forgiveness for, to like confess and to like, you know, take responsibility for his actions.
Okay.
Because the whole other thing is like, he says it wasn't anyone's fault. Like, he took full responsibility for it.
Yeah. But then he says, you talk about yourself a lot. Hmm. So I feel like that confuses the issue if you want to. And he's also been realizing that, like, that's the thing that has driven him to this end is knowing that he alone, whatever aspect of him Mr. Robot is, has done this thing and enjoyed it.
Yeah, and I remember...
So if anything, I feel like it's almost the opposite.
Someone pointed out that, like, when we first met Trenton, that, you know, and they were being introduced to the members of F Society, the introduction was something along the lines of, she's got a little bit of Allahu Akbar in her, which is...
Admiral Akbar?
No, it's just Islamic. It's just the Arabic way of saying God is great, but it's also, you know, it's something that a suicide bomber would shout before they trigger their vest, and that's kind of like,
right.
I think the traditional, the like Western connotation, which is kind of fucked up.
Sure.
But where was I going? Like this? Oh, the fact that like, are they trying to suggest that like, no one put a gun to Trenton or Mobley or Rome. Is that the other guy, Roman?
Romero.
Yeah. Or even Darlene. No one put a gun to these heads. Like, Elliot told them his plan and idea, and they believed in it enough to do it. So, like, I think that's – you're on to something where you say to kids' sake, like, you talk about yourself a lot, like – yeah, you maybe you're the blame for the idea, but it's not like these people didn't get into it with their eyes wide open.
Sure.
I mean, they didn't know they're going to get tricked and made a fool of by the Dark Army and all that other stuff and White Rose, but, you know.
Okay.
All right. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Oh, no problem. Elliot and Muhammad arrive home. Muhammad pulls out a key and opens up the front door. Elliot's not too happy about that. Then the kid apologizes for making Elliot late and hopes he can still do his important thing, which we know is killing himself, and asks if they can see each other again. Elliot promises to take him to the Martian before he moves.
At what point did Elliot decide not to kill himself? Because, like, I felt like
I think it
was
before this.
Okay, because, like, there's a lot of interesting things to discuss in this episode. The fact that the kid having the key the whole time is a reference to
could be a reference to Angela's experience with her younger self, where
key
is in my fist, the fist is in my pocket, the key has been there the whole time,
uh-huh.
and another child kind of like that. But, like, I felt like Elliot losing his shit here when the kid went in to get something was him. Like, I feel like at this point he realized that he can't kill himself because he made a promise similar to the one that he made to Darlene.
Mm-hmm.
And now he's realizing that he has to, you know, kind of be he can't do this to Darlene. Much less he can't do this to his kid, much less to his kid sister.
Okay. Yeah, I could buy that.
And then the lollipop, I felt pretty good because I got that right away since we made such a big deal of the lollipop fixation with Dom from last season.
Mm-hmm.
But clearly, if it points a way forward with Elliot working with Dom, or at least I think that's what the lollipop's supposed to symbolize.
I mean, the idea that this information that he needs, that the keylog data is
also in the FBI, with the FBI, right.
Yeah, the only link we have to the FBI at the moment is Dom. So,
right. I guess, yeah, it's not as clever once you just pause and read the email that Trenton sends at the end.
Right.
Gee, you wonder where you're going to go next, Elliot.
Yeah, we'll talk about that at the end. So Elliot goes back to Mobley's brother with some incriminating info that he got from hacking him, and he tells him that he's going to have a funeral for Mobley, whether he likes it or not. And he also gives him the morphine that he got from Hard Andy, who turns out to be a client of his law firm.
Mmm, shady clients.
Yeah, a lot of shady clients in that law firm, apparently. Anything you want to say about this?
No, I mean,
this
is just the comeuppance. Reminds me of early season one of Mr. Robot, where I thought this was going to be like a hack of the week kind of thing, where it's going to be like kind of like Justified, where there'll be a narrative arc, but also Elliot will take down the child pornographer running a coffee shop de jour,
or Krista's cheating boyfriend, husband.
He's going to be like a hacker vigilante, like before it became this big fucking space opera.
Yeah,
but it was just him doing justice on a personal level, mm-hmm. For some fucker that
for his friend,
right,
yeah.
All right, that's almost even kind of an interesting meta conversation that, like, Muslims are not in this dichotomy of, like, good people and terrorists. They can just be a shit bird like anybody else.
Sure, yeah. They're just the mundane run-of-the-mill.
They can take dirty money and be corrupt and, like, you know, they're not angels and they're not devils. They're just fucking people like anybody.
Right. Yeah, and I think that's why, you know, Trenton's dad is so grateful when he says something nice about her, because he's just treating them like people.
Right.
Not like Muslims, you know,
right.
They're human beings. So Elliot finally goes to see Angela. She won't open the door, so he sits in the hall and he reminisces aloud about the wishing game that they used to play. And those wishes never came true, but they enjoyed it all the same, and that seems to help Angela.
Well, I thought the part where it's like the ending wasn't our favorite part anyway was... I mean, this is what Angela's been doing with White Rose, right?
Mm-hmm.
She's been playing the wishing game, and she opened her eyes, and, oh, shit, 71 buildings are on fire.
Yeah.
So this is, I guess, like, Elliot's taking this moment of, like, forgiveness and grace that he got from this kid and is trying to pass it on to Angela.
And I almost wonder if Elliot hasn't come to some better understanding about, you know, what Mr. Robot is. It's like the part of him that wishes his father was still alive and so that he could make amends, the way that he's doing with, like, trying to do with Mobley and Trenton after the fact.
Right.
Because this wishing game, the way he describes it is, it's a game they played knowing full well that these wishes would never come true. He's never going to get his dad back. Angela's never going to get her mom back. But that wasn't the part that excited them about the wishing game. Like, the end result. It was more about, like, following the wish. Like, actually doing the wishing. It was just, like, the remembrance of their parents, right?
Yeah, and also the part at the end where, like, no matter what happens, we'll be okay. I mean, that's an important thing to remember. Like, no matter what shit you're going through, like, you're going to be okay. You're still breathing, and as long as that's happening, you still got a fighting chance. And, you know, it's like one thing that was like a kind of mantra that I learned in therapy is that, like, you say that you're going to be okay because you already are, you know? Like the act of getting help and the act of taking steps and the act of, you know, becoming more aware of your state of mind is, like, just part of the healing that's already... It's like, you know, after an accident when you're in a hospital bed,
you got a long road ahead of you, and it sucks, and it's going to be hard, and you're going to need medicine and doctoring and physical therapy and all that stuff, but you're already okay. You're out of the ICU and all that, and that's like something that is important when you're going through a tough time.
Unless you're on an episode of House, and then never be sure that you're out of the
woods.
Then
it's lupus.
Yeah.
And it's going to finally come and claim you, so.
For sure. Until House swoops in. You just got to find House.
Yeah.
You'll be all good. All right, Ellie goes home where Mr. Robot, where the Mr. Robot jacket is dumped off on the sidewalk in front of him.
I don't know why this doesn't bother me more, because I'm the infamous, like, fuck 'em, 737 down over ABQ, fish NATO.
Right. It's a huge coincidence.
It is a huge coincidence. On the other hand, this all seems self-contained within Elliot's neighborhood.
He probably just walked
down
the street.
It's not like he went to Brooklyn and then went home to his new, and like, you know, it's,
yeah,
it's a lot more likely when stuff stays in the same geographic coordinates. And also, again, this show, it played this trick where it's just dreamlike enough that I accepted things on both a literal and not an emotional level.
Yep. Yeah. I wasn't really looking for the literal storytelling here.
Yeah, which I cannot defend that. I cannot, like, if you listen to my season one or my season two of Fargo or my season two Breaking Bad podcast or any other time, I get fucking all bent out of shape about a coincidence.
But I feel like if they set you up properly and say, look, don't worry about how this logically connects. Like, I'm going to go back to The Fly, right?
The whole palette has been changed. Like, they're painting with a different, and I was ready to go for it, where it's like, it's not like I was in the middle of a tight boiler episode of Mr. Robot, and then suddenly, you know, Deus Ex Machina happens.
Right.
I don't, like I said, I don't know that you can defend it. I just coincidences bother me when they're hacky and stupid and come out of nowhere, and this didn't seem like it was, so.
Yeah. So he takes the jacket and he goes inside and fixes his mirror. He repairs his computer and he finds the email that Trenton sent him, all while talking about how much he would have regretted actually hitting delete.
Yep. Those things that you thought didn't have value that became important, or
the
things you find a purpose for. Like, I remember, you know, speaking of Bitcoin, like, Bitcoin went through the fucking roof over the holiday break. Yeah. And now I have a third time that I can tell everyone that I missed the Bitcoin. Because...
It was 7 grand like a week ago.
3 years ago, we owned 29 Bitcoins.
Yeah, it was above 20, yeah.
And if we had retained those, we would be
100,000.
We'd be a third of the way to billionaires.
No, billionaires. Get out of here.
Million. I said million.
Oh, I thought you said billion.
Well, I'm a mushmouth, so I forget what the fuck I was going on with that. But
no, it's about... The interesting thing to me is how he would have killed himself here right before getting the email that blows it all open. Well, how his life does have value, he just didn't see it.
Well, there's also, like, on r/Bitcoin, like, 3 years ago, when Bitcoin first blew up to 100, there was a guy who came on there who had he had mined, like, 2,000-some in some wallet that he lost he just lost track because they were worth pennies, and he's like...
Fuck.
And I'm like, what? Imagine... So when... When that was like $2 million, that you'd want to kill yourself, right?
Now it's like $2
billion. And now it's like you'd be one of the wealthiest people.
Right.
Yeah. And that's another thing.
You'd be Satoshi himself, right?
Where are the stories of these Bitcoin million and billionaires? Because they absolutely, like, those Winklevoss twins are billionaires on paper.
Multiple things now.
Or on encrypted paper, anyway.
They've been billionaires, now they're probably multi-billionaires.
Yeah, and like, I know, like, there was a guy who had like some 3,000 or 4,000 Bitcoins that back when Bitcoin got to $1,000, he was talking about, you know, how crazy it was, and now, like, Jesus.
The scary thing about Bitcoin to me is I would never know when to sell.
Right.
Because if it gets to 200,000 a coin, and you've got 20 coins, do you sell? That's $4 million bucks.
I don't know. Or, like, there's the story that always goes around.
$40 million.
Is the guy talking about, there's a post from Reddit like four years ago where a guy like spent the first pizzeria that took Bitcoins, he bought a large pizza with 30 Bitcoins.
Oh, Jesus.
And people always think of, like, that's now the X amount dollar pizza. It's now the $300,000 pizza. Yeah, yeah. Like, it's just run. Which, you know, obviously if any economists are listening, there's like a red alarm bell probably, because like this is absolutely a currency whose value is actually not in any kind of exchange of goods. It's a mm-hmm. it's a speculative investment vehicle.
Yeah, but you could go back to fucking Abraham Lincoln and say he bought a corncob pipe for 1 cent. Mm-hmm. It was the world's most expensive corncob pipe because 1 cent right. today is worth $100,000.
That's the opposite of
yeah.
I think what's going on in Bitcoin, but
I think so.
Anyway, tot dab all around.
All right. So yeah, this is the email that I think is going to blow everything wide open. It says something about keylog data that Romero got off the machines that they were using to do all the encoding of the financial record.
Here's what, because I remember us having this debate last year about the fact that this data is not gone, it's encrypted in such a way yeah. that it might as well be, like without the key, and that apparently what F Society did is they encrypted it and then threw away the keys. Mm-hmm. If Romero had used a keylogger, and if you don't know what keylogger, just literally every time you push a key on your computer and sometimes click a mouse, it keeps mm-hmm. track of that in a sequential thing. So what does that tell you? Well, if you played it back and you knew the context, you could tell, you know, people's passwords, you could see what websites they go to, you could literally read the contents of their email, anything they typed into that device.
Right.
So it stands to reason if every terminal had a physical keylogger that at some point someone entered the key and you could decrypt that and play it back and get that key sequence. It would probably be a lot of work to do it, but it's now in within the realms of Mr. Robot possible.
I'm going to go ahead and say less work than setting up an entire new economy.
Yes. Yes. Now, there is an also open question that, like, there's been so much economic damage done.
Yeah.
Like, even
why
at this point,
if
you, like, if you could roll back the economy to, like, 60 days, what does that even fucking mean?
Yeah.
If you could restore everyone's loans and credits and banking, like, I, you know, like, it's...
Like, what happens now? I mean...
It's unprecedented.
Yeah, people would owe the same amount of dollars that they owed before, right?
Right.
Or they would be holding on to the same amount of dollars before, but that... That number, that dollar amount has been so inflated at this point.
Right. Like inflation's good.
What
when
is
you,
that?
Inflation's good when you have debt.
Sure.
It's bad yeah. when you have savings.
Right. So what does that even look like if you restore all that and now you've got this new e-coin currency that everybody's using?
E-coin, or like E-Corp still gets destroyed, right? Because like, you know, if I owned $200,000 on a house, which now could buy a bushel of apples, mm-hmm. well then I... You know, shit, I just write a check for 200 e-coins and I'm done.
Right. So I don't know. It's going to be real interesting if they take this show that direction where they undo yeah. in that way, that they find the decryption keys. Man, I don't even know what that looks like.
Yeah.
I hope they do.
I don't know. Yeah.
I don't know that we'll get there, but
also
maybe.
And everybody, you know, with the bucket of cold water theory for Sam Esmail thrown on time travel, we're now back to like, okay, I don't necessarily subscribe to that theory, but if you do, what the fuck is White Rose doing with her
Congo
particle accelerator in the Congo?
I don't know.
Because that's the other thing.
Computers
like,
and bitcoins, I mean.
Right. Like, you could, like if she wants to manipulate some kind of cryptocurrency, she already did. She did it by just,
you
know.
You don't need a quantum computer to do it.
Seems like you just need the full might of the dark army.
Right. So, yeah, we also find out that keylog data is in the hands of the FBI because they seized it from his place when he died. Enter Dom, right?
This is
the connection that we've been waiting for, like, to see how
Dom's
going to
get involved.
We
thought Dom would go over to Elliot's side.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe it's like they start something completely new. Like, because there's no... Dom cannot work within the rubric of the FBI on this.
No.
So she's definitely going to...
She would have to do it covertly.
Right.
And against her entire organization's wishes.
Right.
But I could see her doing that.
Because her immediate upwards on the chain of command is dirty as fuck.
Yes.
Dirty as a car that hasn't been washed for a year. All right.
That's it.
I think that's it for the episode. It only took us an hour and 12 minutes to work our way through it.
Dense episode. It was, yeah. Very, very heavy, some might say.
Yeah. It's like the opposite of an... That's the thing. Like, action-oriented episodes, super easy to break down because it's just essentially talking about what happened. These emotional imagery heavy episodes, like, you got to talk about feelings and what's it all mean, man? I don't know. Hey, I highlighted our club Christmas, our Mary Culkin Keatmas, and it made me think about all the different Christmas extravaganzas that people might have missed. Let's go back to 2015, a little gem called Cachet La Vue. Jim, could you briefly describe the Cachet La Vue caper?
It's a hilarious practical joke where you went to a family event and you put some fake shit in the
sink. A Christmas party. I went to my aunt's Christmas party.
Lots of family members gathered around, and you put some fake doo-doo right in the sink.
Very realistic fake doo-doo.
Just waiting for people to find it.
Cachet La Vue is a pigeon French translation that means who shit the sink. And I video record. I announced this on a Lunch with Jim and Aaron, got everybody hyped for it, and then I recorded the whole thing from a hidden camera. And we broke it down, Zapruder style. We went through it over that lunch. It's one of the many awesome Christmas projects we've done over the years. It's entertaining and hilarious, and no one got hurt. No one got hurt in the shitting of the sink.
Last year was the Badass Christmas, the Baldwin Badass Christmas, where we watched three badass movies from the biggest badasses around.
And you can imagine it was fucking Nakatomi Plaza. it's Die Hard. It was Die Hard. It was
Jingle All the Way.
It was Rocky IV.
And Rocky IV.
Because Rocky fought Drogo on Christmas Day in Russia. And we did A Wonderful Life for the Christmas surprise. Mm-hmm. Will the Christmas surprise this year be as heartwarming? You'll have to join the club, club.baldmove.com, if you want to know this and many other awesome club features. We talked about the movies. Do you want to hear our spoiler-filled reviews for The Disaster Artist? You got to be in the club member. Do you want to hear a spoiler-filled take for the Last Jedi? Got to be a club member. Club.baldmove.com, and thanks in advance for your support. You in the mood for some feedback?
Nah. We'll skip it this week.
Well, you know, it's been...
You can do it. You and the audience.
It's been a long something.
Sure, let's do some feedback. Why not?
All right. robot@baldmove.com is where you send this stuff. Let's start with Aqua A. Aaron talked about how he thought the super rich groups controlling the world was unbelievable and actually harmful for viewers. I guess he thought it was such an obvious thought that he didn't have to offer an explanation or examples. But for me, it's funny because we currently found out that Russian powers affected our election in the U.S. and are every day finding out how connected our leaders are to Russian powers. Many people in television news have familiar connections to government officials. How the U.S. government attacked black social revolution groups in the 60s, and finally MK Ultra. It's just what we know. If you think Putin can pull strings in the U.S. from Russia, I think many rich people in the USA also do. I also think Aaron is a bit too positive. He gives some reasons why. He doesn't want people to have a reason to be apathetic and give up. I'll give old positive Aaron some hope. Whenever I think the super rich make creating a just and free world impossible, I always think about how a British colony thought a probably derelict British king actually got free. That seems impossible to me, some sort of David and Goliath situation, but it actually happened. So maybe modern people fighting the super rich will get lucky and face a lazy King Louis. Keeps me going and fighting every day. Not to downplay it, Aaron's very clever analogy about social schizophrenia is part of the problem too. Obviously conspiracy theories actually happen. You know, you cited conspiracies actually happen.
Sure.
Like, you know, the
not all
like the FBI infiltrating you know, communist and socialist and black power movements and civil rights movements and trying to fuck around with that, and, you know, the different banana republics we've been involved in and MK Ultra and like the stuff that going on. Although I wouldn't say the Russian stuff is a conspiracy so much as it's just
cyber
military operation.
Yeah.
It's just that, like, I think it's different from conspiracy theories, which are things that don't have any proof, because like and here's my problem is, like, you saying that's just what we know.
But
I kind of think that's the same as saying that's, I mean, what does that even mean? Like, is there a conspiracy theory involving thousands of people that we don't know about? Like, to me, the probability of a conspiracy being uncovered approaches one the more people that are involved and the longer the time.
Sure.
And that's, like, you know, I guess, I don't know. Like,
It's an impossible argument without talking about specific concrete examples, because the stuff you're talking about right now, we're already uncovering evidence. It's not much of a conspiracy so much as it's a...
Oh, but he can't talk about the ones that we don't know about yet.
Right. So, it's fine. Like, rich and powerful people are rich and powerful, and they're going to try to hold on to their wealth and their power, but there's a ton more of us than there are of them, and some of them are on our side, broadly speaking. Like, not every rich and powerful person is a fucking asshole that doesn't see that where they've gotten a society is built on the back of society itself, and they have to keep the framework of society running, or it all comes crashing to a halt. Right. So, like I said, I'm eternally optimistic and hopeful. It's just that zooming into the time period that we're living in, I mean, we could be living in like a Great Depression or, you know, rise of fascism kind of situation. But yet, like we talked about in the podcast, there's still rays of light in those environments.
Yeah, I mean, the way I kind of always understood your like pushback on the believability here is not that it was like, oh, White Rose can control the government of a country and ram, you know, these votes or policies through. It was more like the consolidation of so many different types of power, like being in the financial institutions and so deeply embedded in the political structure of a specific government, and also, you know, in the water treatment facilities and like there were just so many things tied
buying
up in
nations,
like an E-Corp thing where it's cars and phones and banking and all that stuff. But honestly, when we look at companies like Google or Amazon, those are becoming realities. And I know it's not spread to like banking yet. You're not sending your money to Amazon to bank it, but God damn if you don't do just about everything you do on Google.
You got Amazon Pay and you got Google Pay and you got
whatever, and you can get
Apple
credit
Pay.
Cards that are not really through them. It's more through like Chase or something.
But
like
that's the other thing is like these rich people compete amongst themselves as well. They do not.
Yeah.
I mean, that's where you start getting into the Rothschilds and the Illuminati shit. Like if these rich, powerful people are a one block that are entirely united in everything they do, and it spans even the globe. Like it's like once you get so high, it's like you don't even. There's not even. It's just rich society. It's eyes wide shut. That's where it's like no, calm down. Just like we talk about Muslims, these are people of all different types, and they all have different competing ambitions and worldviews and philosophies. And I mean, again, that's what I genuinely believe. And also that it seems like the arrow of progress does point one direction. You can take it's a two steps forward, one step back situation. But you know what point in history since recorded human history began would you switch for someone in right now?
Right.
Like, you know, you want to go 100 years back when women couldn't vote and alcohol was illegal and people died of polio. Your kid had a good chance of being an iron lung. Do you want to go 200 years back where we didn't have fluoride in toothbrushes and even our greatest leaders like Washington like was in crippling dental pain all the time? And he had fucking horse teeth and everything else. Like, you know, 1,000 years. Like, when is a better time to live in than now?
Yeah.
And at what, like, at how many points
hopefully
in history can anyone say, boy, I wish I lived 100 years ago?
Yeah.
And, yeah, hopefully that will continue until an asteroid smacks us or the heat death of the universe claims us. AJW, enjoy the podcast, but no clue what the adjective top dab means. Please explain.
I think you got that.
I think you got that in the top of the podcast. Tammy in Texas. I think Jim is right about Angela. She's been a wooden, emotionless zombie for way too long. I was happy to see her in this childish state, even though it's very sad. At least it's something. I think she's in shock, and this is her way of dealing with it, by her trying to convince herself that all these people aren't dead.
Yeah, I didn't see a 5-year-old. I saw a broken woman there.
Okay.
Is what I saw. A mentally just destroyed person.
Well, I'm glad you're engaged with Angela.
Yeah,
because
finally, it took three seasons.
I've enjoyed her low this time. Actually, other than season one, like I've enjoyed Angela since she became something other than the annoying friend-zoned object of Elliot's affection.
Yeah,
that's kind of like the eternal carrot that's dangling just out of his grasp. Like, she's become so much more interesting
now that she's taken on this kind of agency and role of her own. Hallow, I don't think I've seen it mentioned anywhere else, but have you noticed that during the scenes at Mar-a-Lago, there are zero women in the room? I did not notice that.
Hmm.
But it is an interesting observation.
I'll say, God. I guess I would expect a certain type of woman to be in that room.
Also, are we counting White Rose?
No, I mean, obviously not.
That's the thing, like, well, I don't know.
Otherwise, the count would be one. Like, I mean...
Well, yeah, that's what I'm saying, like, because that's where it gets tricky. Like, I don't know if people... I mean, I got an email about it, but I felt self-conscious where, like, when White Rose is Zhang, I tend to refer to him as he. Mm-hmm. When White Rose is in her White Rose, I tend to refer to her as she.
It's all about presenting to me.
That's like
what are you presenting yourself as? What do you want me to think you are in this moment?
Yeah, it seems like you can't go wrong by going with what someone's trying to present as.
Yeah.
And with a person like Zhang / White Rose, where, you know, even their personal assistant that is aware of both of their roles refers to him as in a masculine pronoun and a masculine name and in private.
Yeah.
When he's wearing a suit, makes it think like, and the fact that so many of these characters have dual characterizations, like it, I don't know. It's, but it's,
I think it's a little
where,
confusing with White Rose too, because I don't think that White Rose wants to present as a man necessarily when she is.
That's the thing. Like, what does Zhang / White Rose think in their hearts of hearts? Do they identify as a woman or as a man or as a switch?
But
I'm
not comfortable putting that on them, right? Like, you can't say, no, you really want to be a woman, so I'm going to call you she.
Right. And the character itself has been silent on the subject.
Right.
So it's like, I don't think I'm misgendering. First of all, it's a fictional character.
Yeah.
So the stakes of me hurting their feelings are very low.
No. There will never be an episode where White Rose says, Aaron, you hurt my feelings.
Right. When you miss, but also it's like, how do you misgender someone that hasn't clearly expressed and has switches their present? It's a tough one for me. Like I said, I try to do the right thing, but Zhang / White Rose is hard for me to get my handle on. Scott says, you keep mentioning how unrealistic the economic situations of Mr. Robot are, but they spoke to a lot of experts to inform the writing, and he connects me to a Medium.com article.
Medium is no economic expert. Come on.
Well, it's an interview with Cora Donna, who we talked is like, you
He's
know,
a co-producer.
Their advisor. And he does mention that they talk to, I mean, he doesn't mention them by name, but he says that they talk to economic advisors about, you know, what the world would look like, and they compared like the banking crisis of Greece and the Great Depression, and to me, so I feel like after reading, and thank you, Scott, for sending me the article, I feel like their heart is in the right place, but because of budget or production, they're just not selling it. Again, it's like episode one, where clearly you're supposed to understand the Naboo people are deeply hurting, but you just never see it. And every time you do see it, it seems like it's business as usual. So a disparity between what their I don't know what their research said. Like I haven't yet seen a bread line. Like all I see is trash in the streets and people buying batteries and apples for grossly inflated pricing.
I really, really wish.
And like, people are intense, obviously. That's an uptick of homelessness, I guess.
Here's the thing. We've done some jokes. I know nobody who's listening to this listens to Walking Dead, but we cover The Walking Dead, and we've made these jokes about how they should hire us as the writers because we could do a better job, right?
Yeah.
I really wish that someone on one of these shows would hire me as like a historian or something of the show itself so that I can go document all of these fucking conversations that happen that would be so fascinating as special features. Like, what if I could get in the room with Sam Esmail and Cora Donna, and when they're talking to their economic advisors, did the conversation look like?
I would watch 4 hours of unedited footage.
I'd watch 100 hours.
Yeah,
get it on Twitch.
On the Blu-ray, like, of them talking about the different and brainstorming and all that stuff. Like,
You could make a full box set of every season with six discs.
Someone's going
discs.
To do it. Someone is going
they
to
need
do
to.
Like, because I. The other thing is, like, I want a podcast. Well, like my friend Kim Renfro on The Insider does this thing called Showrunners, where it's a podcast where she interviews different and her other people, other associates at The Insider interview showrunners. I want someone like a Dan Harmon or a Sam Esmail or a Vince Gilligan
to actually film large chunks of the writer's room. Like, just have a camera going in the writer's room from the time they walk in to the time they break it down and make it into, like, an eight-hour feature of how, like, a season of a show gets made. Because I think, and I know it's, and that's the other thing, is, like, that could be, it happens differently in different writer's room, and I think it's endlessly fascinating. I would love to see those kind of special features.
And we're going that way with our content in general, right? Like, we want that kind of insider access. And if you
want
to,
like, commentaries, we want behind-the-scenes features.
You could make money off of a show that never fucking airs if you just put a camera in the writer's room and says, and say, pay us a subscription fee for the 9 months that we're writing and shooting thing, and you'll have insider access. $6.99 a month. Boom.
There's no way, because of spoilers.
Yeah, I guess you couldn't do it pre. It'd have to be after it.
Now, I thought you were going with, like, this was a failed pilot that never got picked up.
Yeah, you
but
could
this
do that.
Was like, you
and
could
this
do
is
that,
everything we filmed.
Here's how we came up with the show Bible.
We're
going to
spool it out for X months, and you can get it all.
Yeah. No, I mean, we're, like, super nerds about this. I don't know if it would be. But, like, that's the thing, is that shit's cheap. Like, how much does it cost to have a couple wireless webcams that are feeding into some big NAS and pay an intern to go through and either put it all in bulk for, like, the super fans, or, like, edit it down to its most interesting bits?
It's a great idea, and I think the first show to, like, experiment with that kind of stuff will see that it's totally worth it.
Yeah. Mike from Louisiana, simple question. If the country world just went through a major financial crisis and terrorist attack, do you think people would still cosplay a Back to the Future marathon?
That's
love
the
show, but major tot dab alert.
And, you know, Back to the Future transcends the end of the world, I gotta say.
Well, it's interesting, because as I was putting up my Christmas lights, I was on my ladder, and I had this thinking, I'm like, because I was thinking about this tax bill that's currently winding its way through Congress, and I'm like, because I'm convinced that these policies are identical to the ones that got us into the Great Depression.
I thought you were going to say the Biff Tannen implements when he becomes a leader of the free world.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like, what happened is General Flynn stole the 1984 Sports Almanac, and that's how. I'm very convinced that, like, these are the exact same policies that, like, the Coolidge administration enacted in 1926 that led to the Great Depression. Uh-huh. And I was thinking, as I was putting up the Christmas lights, I'm like, man, I don't want to go. Like, I built myself this nice life. I've got this podcasting thing, and, like, you know, my son is you know, he's 11 years old. What the fuck is he going to do? And I thought, like, well, if the world goes to shit, I still bought these Christmas lights, and I've got a shit ton of bulbs, and, like, you know, if I can afford electricity, I can still have a nice Christmas, like, you know, and these people had nice Doc Brown costumes, and, like they're Back to the Future fans, and it's like,
hey, you're not going
to
throw them out.
Yeah, I got this cosplay thing. Let's, like, it doesn't cost me anything. Let's go out and represent.
Yeah.
Maybe. Or maybe it's a giant tot dab violation. I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe Doc Brown costumes are super cheap on eCoin.
I got to say, I felt like Doc Brown trying to connect my Christmas lights this year, because I was, like, up on a step stool, leaning over, trying to desperately connect two lights that didn't quite have the reach.
Yeah.
It was a bad scene.
I almost fell off my roof and died.
Just like Doc Brown.
I can't.
You hung onto your clock, your giant tower.
I did. I can't climb a 10-12 pitch like I could as a teenager, apparently. Brent J, sometimes when you're barreling towards chaos, it's nice to take a breath. That's why I enjoyed this episode, even though it felt like we're just wasting a bit of time. The wonderful pop culture touchstones this week were top-notch, not just Back to the Future. If you haven't, you owe it yourself to watch Danny Boyle's debut film, Shallow Grave, starring none other than Mapleton's own Matt Jameson.
Oh, shit. I didn't realize it was Danny Boyle.
Right?
That's the 30 Days Later guy.
Yeah. Not sure if the themes of the film seep into the episode. It's one of my favorite films, and I really enjoyed the reference. I'm ashamed to admit, until I got this feedback, that I assumed that this was a careful massacre of the bourgeoisie kind of fake. Because I'm like, I recognize the Jerky Boys and the other film, but, like, Shallow Grave, what the fuck? I felt like that was just a made-up film. So now I know it's not.
No, it's not. I also said 30 Days Later. I meant 28.
You've done that a lot. See, it's starting. It's starting. The neurons are... I am a shadow reflection of what you'll be like in 5 years.
Fuck.
Right? Dan G, love the episode. Very good use of metaphor for the of deletion for death or suicide.
Yeah.
I'm not sure, but I thought the kid seemed like a figment of Elliot's imagination. That maybe they set up that first scene of the young Elliot talking to the empty chair in the cinema, who's presumably not his dad he was seeing, so he's had many other imaginary friends. There's a lot of evidence that this could be made up, and that's one of the strongest ones, the fact that they filmed Elliot turning to Mr. Robot and shushing him in a very similar way to Elliot turning to the other empty seat and realizing that the character's no longer there.
Yeah.
But like we said, I can't get around the fact that Muhammad was directly addressed by at least two people, or seen by two people.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, people like, oh, why is the mosque empty? Well, it wasn't worship night, and also there's a fucking curfew. Mm-hmm. And, you know, why? And like, all the other settings where they were at, it made sense for people not to. The only thing that didn't make sense is the kid's parents abandoning him. Like, I still can't make sense of why a family who is grief-stricken about losing their daughter and fears for their Muslim lives in a hostile city would just be like, where's Muhammad? He's gone? Fuck it, let's go. We gotta go to Connecticut.
Your brother's waiting.
Your brother is, yeah. I do think he's intended to be real. Matt, to the extent that if it's not, I feel like Esmail's got some explaining about the direction and production of this episode. And he did, he was the credited writer and director, so the buck definitely stops with him on this one. Mm-hmm. Matt from Philly, is there an Emmy nomination for a cold open? Because Sam Esmail deserves one. I consistently love what the show does before you get to the title. The retro movie was super cool and nostalgic, and even got some Breaking Bad vibes from Mr. Robot collapsing like we'd seen Walter White do with his cancer. Did you notice that after the intro, the show stayed in a wider screen format than we usually have? I don't believe it changes back past the introduction. It gave the episode a more different cinematic feeling, in my opinion, but I wonder if you guys think there's a greater meaning. Is this a part of another Elliot's delusions, or was it just artistic flair by the director? It did lead to some amazing cinematography, like Elliot and Angela leaning against opposite sides of the door of her apartment. So this is true. The show starts off in standard 16:9... aspect ratio, and then once we get on board the cinematic roller coaster ride and go through the horrifying gumdrops and diseased leprosy ridden popcorn kernels that would not be saved by dumping a bag of M&Ms into, by the way, we go to CinemaScope.
Okay, what ratio is CinemaScope?
I don't know.
23 to 0.
Divides by zero, yeah. Which is why you never. That's why televisions aren't capable of it. They have to do the black bars. What does it mean?
I didn't even notice this. Like I went on Reddit and I saw a thread about it, and I went back and tried to notice.
I verified that it did happen,
and I still didn't notice it.
The way you can notice it is like the AMC. You know, I mean, the fact there's black bars on the screen, like, you know, and the fact that the AMC bug is, or not USA, the AMC, yeah. The USA bug is in the black bar where it's normally not. It would be interesting if, because I keep talking about like this being the fulcrum of the series, or maybe the turning point of the series. It would be interesting if he just purely from a stylistic point of view, every episode from here is CinemaScope to reflect the new reality that Mr. Robot's operating in. I don't think he will, because, you know, he does shit like this. The Alf episode.
Yeah.
I just think he was going broke for some of these visuals and some of the cinematic storytelling conventions, and why not?
Sure.
It's fun.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing, like, Mr. Robot becomes pretentious, leaves fun and becomes pretentious to the exact level that its overall execution is. Like, some of this shit would be unsufferable if season 3 wasn't excellent.
Yeah.
But since it is, it's a fun thing you can admire, not something that you worry about Sam Esmail jerking off over in favor of actual script and character and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
So I don't know. Do you have a feeling about what it means?
Not at all.
Okay. No,
zero. Sorry.
John from Maryland. This is the dissenter.
Okay.
Not a big fan of this week's episode, my friends. The dialogue, especially the Darlene and Elliot scene, was pretty lame. And I don't really buy the plot with the kid as a realistic thing that would happen in Esmail's universe. He's typically better at eschewing a convention and keeping you on your toes, but it felt cheap for them to make it seem like Elliot's really about to off himself, and at the very last second, this kid comes out of nowhere and saves his life. Can we dispense with the fake suspense of the show's single essential character dying mid-season? It'll probably stand that Elliot's suicidal thoughts are insulated in this episode, and so Ep didn't really progress the plot in a meaningful way, with the exception of him receiving the email from Trenton. I'm in violent disagreement at the final paragraph.
About not moving anything forward?
Yeah, because Elliot being suicidally depressed and needing morphine or prison or something other extreme to function, him saying, I don't need these anymore, to a big bag of morphine, and finding, because he now found a new purpose for himself, I think is a turnaround. Mm-hmm. And I will be very disappointed if it's not.
Yeah, I'm a little scared that this is going to be another time that they've done this with Elliot, because I do feel like he's had these sort of plateaus with Mr. Robot,
but
where things
always
have fundamentally changed, but they've, I don't know, I'm hoping that this is a little bit different.
Yeah. I mean, it is unrealistic if he just magically cures himself and doesn't need medicine anymore or anything like that, but
yeah.
Every time else he's had a high, it seems like it's been on the back of morphine or Ritalin or something like that. Mm-hmm. Whereas this just seems like, I don't know, a genuine breakthrough, which sometimes happens with people.
Sure, it does. I'd like to see him go talk to Krista.
I think, for sure, for sure. That might be a plot. The fact that he starts taking medicine again, and it starts fogging him up, and like he's not as sharp as he was, and there's, you know, there's some stakes between, like, you know. We talked about what the end of Mr. Robot is, or what a victory condition, and I've always said the victory condition is kind of like Elliot being happy.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe the choice is between him living a quiet, normal, happy life and him, you know, being this tortured genius that can still somehow save the world through his hacking ability.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. But I will. That's the one thing that I think the show could clearly piss me off, is if this isn't a turnaround and a real change for the character, and he just goes back to status quo.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm fine with him yo-yoing, because, like, you know, people are kind of pendulums, but,
mm-hmm.
you know, there should be, you know.
But I think Mr. Robot and Elliot had sort of an understanding that they reached at the end of last episode, you know, it was one before that, where they both now understand that they're being manipulated. Mr. Robot thought he was in control.
And are we to understand that Mr. Robot's been gone for 3 weeks?
I guess so.
That's what my understanding was, too, which is amazing. Like Mr. Robot himself is in a shame-hiding circumstance.
Yeah, there's nothing to indicate he's still there. But it's going to be interesting when he hooks back up with Krista, because she just found out that he's the guy who maybe started this whole thing.
Uh-huh.
She might push to try and talk to Mr. Robot, and bad things could happen from there. She might accidentally be a catalyst for slipping back into this.
Yeah, that's a good point, too.
Which would be completely ironic and delicious, almost.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. Like, he's going to be put in an involuntary psych hold.
Right.
Right when he needs to save the world.
I don't know. We'll see how it goes. But Krista's definitely has a part to play.
Do you think we'll see White Rose before the end of this episode, or the end of the season?
Yes.
I'm 100% on that. What about Philip Price?
Ooh. Yeah. Yeah. Like I said before, I think Philip still has some thrashing to do. Although it's been 3 weeks.
It's been 3 weeks. And I'm thinking, like, we might... I wouldn't be surprised if we just saw him... Like, you know, E-Corp executive commit suicide after,
maybe,
like, that kind of,
on,
like,
live television.
You understand that, like, White Rose has struck again.
Yeah.
Because I'm with you with the thrash, but once I saw the 3-week time jump, I'm like, I don't know. why has he not been thrashing?
Yeah.
Because New York's on lockdown. Okay, that's the last email. We ended up with a negative take, but not for me.
No, okay.
I'm still entirely positive with 2 episodes to go.
Yeah, I'm really excited to see how they follow through. The next, I won't do any spoilers, but the next episode's title has me excited.
Oh, I haven't even seen it.
Oh boy, it's a doozy.
All right, it's like, no, go ahead, delete me.
Right, yeah.
.zip.
Yeah.
So we're going to leave it there. If you'd like to send us feedback, do so. robot@baldmove.com, or you can go on forums, forums.baldmove.com. To discuss it with discuss the episodes with your fellow friends. Follow us along on your social media of choice. Just search us for Bald Movie. It'll come up. And what else? What else do I usually say?
I think that's it.
Thanks for listening. Yep. We will be back here next Friday for another round of Mr. Robot. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
Have a nice weekend. See you.